All right, welcome in, everybody. It's Dave Plyer here on 720 WGN. We have got a big, big show for you tonight as we celebrate the 40th anniversary of the iconic Chicago-based film, The Blues Brothers. Now, Dan Aykroyd grew up a good Catholic boy up in Ontario, and he was determined to be a priest until the age of 17. And then he settled on a new career path. Dan joined the Second City in 1973, first worked in Toronto, then here in Chicago. Saturday Night Live made its debut in 1975 and included Dan as one of the not-ready-for-primetime players. John Belushi was also an original SNL cast member, and he and Dan joined forces to first perform the Blues Brothers skit back in 1978. It proved to be so popular that the Blues Brothers movie was filmed in 1980. It's become a cult classic, and this weekend it turns 40 years old. Now, Dan is now hosting a new TV series called Hotel Paranormal. He's also an entrepreneur. His award-winning Crystal Head Vodka is now sold in more than 55 countries around the world. And to celebrate it all, legendary actor, comedian, musician, and filmmaker Dan Aykroyd joins us tonight. Dan, great to talk to you again.
Oh, good to talk to you, Dave, out there in Chicagoland and, of course, the world and the age of global communications we're living with.
That is correct, yeah.
Well, I love how you say determined to be a priest. What happened there was my mother wanted me to go to this Catholic school. She thought I'd get a better education. And when the priest that I had the interview with asked me to, you know, straight up to declare whether I wanted this vocation for my life, you know, Dan, he was an Irish, a sort of Irish Ontario. Dan, do you think that this is your calling? You think you'd like to join the priesthood? And here was my answer. So I had fun, though. I was able to learn a lot about the Catholic legal system. And then on the movie, we do predict abuse in the Catholic Church because I was... As a schoolboy, I had the ruler laid to me, and the nun in the movie, she lays on the pointer there. So we were predicting in the movie. We were also predicting the militarization of the police with the National Guard chasing the boys, and also the surveillance culture that we live in with the SMODs, the computers and all the squad cars. Yeah, so when you think of what we were put in that movie, a lot of it's relevant today.
It totally is. I know it totally is. And you're talking about being in school, Catholic school, and how much you actually did put in the movie since you wrote it, of course. But when you were at a young age, you really didn't intend on getting into comedy and acting. You studied criminology and other things in school. What changed it for you, Dan, that you said, I'm kind of going to go in this direction?
Well, it was never an intention to go into theater or comedy. It was just there as kind of a hobby, extracurricular school thing, and just something that seemed fun and in high school and college. And really, you're right. It wasn't an intention. I had expected to go into sociology, but I met a woman named Valerie Bromfield. She's in the movie Nothing But Trouble, the movie I directed that ended my directing career. But nonetheless, a good serviceable comedy. You can get it. I've got young kids and millennials walking up and saying they love that picture.
Yeah, absolutely.
A lot of good comedy in it. Valerie Bromfield, she plays a police officer in the movie. We met at Immaculata High School where she was doing plays and I was doing plays. I was at St. Pius X, and in that parochial Catholic system, there were some really actually good educators, really fine educators and fine people. You know, you can't lump everybody in there, the whole scandal there. There were many, many good men, and I got a good education, and there were many fine, really great, conscientious, dedicated people, and the theater programs were good. So I met Valerie in a theater program. We started to write sketches together. And we sold them to a television station. We had a show called Change for a Quarter. Mm-hmm. It was a black and white 15-minute show where we did these little sketches with three robot cameras and one operator. And that was back when videotape was 1 inch wide. And it came in a big blue suitcase. And so we started to develop sketches and ideas and eventually went to Second City. And, she college, basically. That was, you're not going to be a prison guard, she said. You're coming with me to Toronto. So she opened my eyes, and we were partners in comedy. We wrote. We worked for Lorne Michaels the summer of 1969 on the Great Canadian Humor Test. We wrote and performed on that together. And I went to join Lorne in Saturday Night. Now Valerie's an educator. She's a guidance educator and one of the funniest and smartest and greatest people. So I was kind of busted out of that formal, headed towards a career in government by that that great lady.
That's amazing. That's pretty cool. I know you were also doing a show on CBC called The Hart and Lorne Terrific Hour, and that was Andrea Martin. It was Victor Garber. But is that where you met Lorne Michaels, or was it before that, Dan?
Yeah. Yes, I met Lorne a little previous to that when I went to CBC with some shows with Valerie, and they sort of the generation there that was running the Wayne and Schuster show and other things, they kind of didn't get our comedy, but they said, well, there's somebody downstairs in an office downstairs in room whatever named Lorne Michaels. He might get this better than we're getting it here.
That's
so
awesome.
We went down there, and he hired us for that summer. And that's where I met Lauren, yes.
Mm-hmm. That's very cool. You know, you talked about Second City, obviously on Ontario and back here in Chicago, where you met John Belushi, Harold Ramis, among others. But, you know, I'm assuming your time here, you still look back fondly on your time here in Chicago.
Oh, I think it's my adopted American city. It's the city that adopted me. When I first got my working papers as a Canadian immigrant to the U.S., or I would say resident alien, I got my papers to go to work in Chicago. That was my first H-1, was to go work at the Second City. So, and John Candy had the place pretty wired. We swapped companies. The Toronto company went down in 74, the summer 74, and performed in Chicago. Chicago company came to Toronto. And Candy came up to Toronto with the Chicago company. But he had the place just wired out. All the great restaurants, all the great little clubs, just Wells Street.
Oh, yeah.
And, the...
Old Town. It's fabulous.
The Old Town and the taverns and little bars and, just little spots. And then, of course, Wise Fools, Kingston Mines, Blues on Halsted, Buddy Guys, Legends, the first one. Now there's another one. But
sure.
So, yeah, I was getting... That summer of 74 was very instrumental in conceiving the Blues Brothers because I was being exposed to great harp playing, taking lessons from a guy named Little Joe Burson and listening to Lurie Bell, Carrie Bell, and all these great players and going to see them in the clubs and just really appreciating their gifts and enjoying that music. And then also reading the papers at the time about how, the Department of Education, the government, Cook County assessor was going to tax some church properties, and that made them, whoa, church and state. I thought that was an interesting kind of political dynamic that maybe there might be the roots of something there. So I took a lot of Chicago with me out of that summer of 74, and I think it was instrumental in writing the Blues Brothers, just locations, the archetypes,
That's very cool. Very cool. We're talking to Dan Aykroyd, and there's more after this on 720 WGN.
First you trade the Cadillac for a microphone. Then you lie to me about the band. Now you're going to put me right back in the joint.
They're not going to catch us. We're on a mission from God.
Player on 720 WGN. We're talking to TV and movie icon Dan Aykroyd on the 40th anniversary of the Blues Brothers film. Now, so you were hired as the youngest member of the first SNL cast. You were originally hired as a writer, though, right?
That's right. I was 23 and spent the first year working as a writer-performer, but only being paid as a writer. Right. And I was very happy for that. Very happy and felt very fortunate. And then the arrangement changed. As obviously I was performing more, I had to be, compensated in that. So we went to...
Did you like...
We went to deal.
Yeah, did you like writing more than acting, or did you like both? Because, you really had a knack to nail what you wrote in your performances. Did you like doing both?
I enjoyed working with my collaborators. I do love writing, especially with people like Harold Ramis, John Landis, Tom Davis, Mike O'Donohue, Alan Zweibel. Chevy, all the people, Gilda, Jane, Lorraine, all the people we had on the show, Rosie and Ann Beats. I loved writing with them, and I do love writing. It's my favorite kind of way to make a living because I don't have to really go anywhere. And, and I can start with a blank piece of paper and a blank idea or blank air. And if I work for 5 hours, there will be five pages there, whether they're good or not. That's mm-hmm. for others to judge, I suppose. But I had fun writing. I did. It's an arduous contrivance, as Churchill said, an arduous contrivance. But I did enjoy the collaborations with the people that I was writing with, and you know I got a few movies made there, and the sketches on SNL, which they let us produce. When you'd write a sketch, you had to effectively produce it. You'd have to talk to them about the lighting, the sets, the costumes, the music. That was Warren. What he did was he cloned out so many producers from SNL. Like there's dozens working in Hollywood now because they were producing their own sketches. If they wrote a sketch on SNL, they'd have to produce it and do the detailed work that made them look good.
And it's amazing to even think that, I mean, this is 1975, so I mean, this was a new kind of show. It was actually Saturday night. I don't think it was even live was part of that at that point. But, you know, you're really trailblazing for just a whole new level of comedy. And this is now, I just realized this at this fall, is 45 years since that very first premiere. And you think about all the lifelong friends you made out of this, but probably, as you said, what you learned on the set as well.
Oh, no, there's no doubt. It was the university. We got our PhD in television there, no question. And it was live from the very first show. Lauren made sure that the network ordered seven so we could get some traction. And it was big after the third or fourth show. People knew there was something different. It was a model built upon the Colgate Palmolive Comedy Hour, show of shows, the mm-hmm. Sid Caesar shows, the Milton Berle, you know, Texaco Comedy Star Theater. All that was live comedy done in the same studios. Some of it, 8H, some of those shows, and Lauren wanted to revive that form. Because he'd worked at Laugh-In, where you had the taped and pre-taped and videotaped and no live audience. He wanted to go back to the live audience, go back to what it must have felt like on a Saturday night to go down to Rockefeller Center, what it felt like in the 30s and 40s and 50s and see a live show televised or broadcast to the world, you know, and that was his vision and it endures today. And it will go on, I am sure, when Lauren is on full-time oxygen, he will be able he'll be able to see and still produce that show, and he'll be 106, and he'll still be doing the running order. The running order of dress rehearsal.
I think you're right about that, and you think about it today, that's the only show that really is performed truly live. I mean, everything else is so edited down and taped, but there is something invigorating, and I'm sure you agree, just being on stage in Second City, of the exhilaration that you have being in front of a live studio audience and performing.
Sure, live is always adrenaline pumping. It's a little exhausting afterwards, but no, there's nothing like it, you know, just for immediate gratification as a performer, that's for sure.
Yeah. We're talking a little bit about the Blues Brothers. Tell us about the Holland Tunnel Blues Bar back in New York.
I had a motorcycle in New York, and I was looking for a place to park it, really. So I was walking on Hudson Street, and I saw this at Dominic and Hudson. There was this, you know, bar that looked closed up, but it was obviously a bar from some old days, and mm-hmm. I called the number. It was for rent. I called the number, and the guy called me. He was an Irish cat that lived over there in Far Rockaway, and I said, "I'd like to rent your bar. How much is it?" $350 a month. $350 a month.
Yeah.
I thought, that's motorcycle storage for sure. That's perfect. Get in there, and get in there, and the bar's not too bad, you know, and it's a nice old bar with the cracked mirror at the back and beautiful back bar, and a little raw in terms of plumbing. There was a ditch, I think, at one point. We always had roses in the ladies' washroom. And it was fully armored with, steel doors and really secure so that we could lock it up and have a good time, never hear anything. So I it sort of evolved after we put a Seabird jukebox stacked with, you know, blues and Stax Volt hits on it.
Sure.
And stocked the bar and cleaned it up. It became a great sort of party space. I wrote a good part of the movie there in the afternoons, just quietly sitting at the bar, you know, in the dark there. I wrote a large part of the Blues Brothers movie in that bar. Yeah, so that was the first blues bar. Many luminaries came through. We used to have an after party after the Saturday Night Live party, and then we would have the after party.
Sure.
At the blues bar, and you know, you'd see the limos lined up along the block there, and you know, we had all that. Everybody that played on the show and musically came in there. You know, ZZ Top, Mick Jagger, wow. David Bowie.
It's incredible. I mean, and you were going up. This wasn't your first exposure to blues. You were going to blues, you know, bars and stuff back in Canada. You got to jam with Muddy Waters back there.
Well, the first club that we used to go to, Le Hibou, it's called an owl in French. It was all of the great artists that you'd see in Chicago at any given time at that time would come through. Everyone would come through there. All of the great artists. And Muddy Waters was playing one night at this club. And, you know, I remember the night James Cotton walked out with his microphone, his 50-foot mic cord, right out into a blizzard and played out in the street in a blizzard, you know.
Wow.
And then back in. We had Muddy Waters there. He was in the club, and S.P. Leary had not come back to the drum kit, and Muddy was looking for someone to play. Everybody else was on the bandstand, and he said, anybody play drums out there? And I put my hand up, and he said, come on up, and sat down, and I started a song. I forget what it was, but, you know, and I got the beat going, and the guitar started to come in, and Muddy looked at me and said, keep that beat going, boy, you make Muddy feel good. And then S.P. Leary sort of darted out and threw me off the kit because, you know, he was out.
Yeah.
So, but that was among many experiences in that little club and seeing the artists that, you know, I saw Sam and Dave at Expo 67, which was the World's Fair. I saw Jimi Hendrix burn his guitar at the Capitol Theater on stage. So like any kid growing up there, I was exposed to these great African-American artists and this amazing culture that has changed the world in such a beautiful way and given us the music we listen to today across a broad range of styles.
Absolutely. And I mean, blues has always been in your soul. And, you know, even with knowing, you know, John Belushi, he grew up in Chicago or here, but you actually introduced him to the blues. I mean, you really kind of put that into his mind.
You know, he was, he loved rock and roll. He loved heavy metal. He was, you know, he played bass and drums, and he loved the punk movement, which came along just sort of on the cusp of where we were.
Mm-hmm.
He loved Grand Funk and Cream. And that night, we were listening to this record in about a couple of years before SNL, 1.5 years before, I think it was in 73, 74, around there, I guess it was. And my memory's a little hazy on it, but we were in the blues bar and listening to a blues record. And he said, this is cool, good music. Yeah, I'm a local blues band. Tom Child, blues band, record straight up, was playing on the old turntable on the fridge. And we sort of concocted the act that night. You know, well, we both like to sing. I play a little harp, you know. Hey, it's got those are neat songs to sing.
Wow.
And it was that night that we really came up with it.
I'm saying the Blues Brothers were born. We're talking to TV icon and movie icon Dan Aykroyd, and there's more after this on 720 WGN.
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses. Hit it.
We're so glad to see so many of your lovely people here tonight, and we would especially like to welcome all the representatives of Illinois' law enforcement community who have chosen to join us here in the Palace Hotel Ballroom. At this time, we do sincerely hope you all enjoy the show, and please remember, people, that no matter who you are and what you do to live, thrive, and survive, there are still some things that make us all the same. You, me, them, everybody needs somebody.
Today, player on 720 WGN, we're talking to TV movie icon Dan Aykroyd on the 40th anniversary of the Blues Brothers film. So you were talking, Dan, about, you know, when the Blues Brothers were kind of born and hanging out at the Holland Tunnel Blues Bar that you were leasing out in New York. How did the band come together? Was it, did Paul Schaefer kind of help you form that group that played with you guys?
Oh, no doubt. I knew Paul from Toronto, from the Godspell and Second City days up here in Toronto and Canada. And I knew Paul very well. And we were friends by the time we both hit SNL. We were good friends already. And he helped us pick the songs. And Tom Malone said, you know, where the horns are in, Paul's in. You know, we need guitar players. And how about Cropper and Dunn? And John and I are going, would Otis Redding's guitar players actually even consider something like this? And because, again, they saw that we were respecting the artists.
Yeah.
And we were putting together something in the spirit of veneration, but also fun, in the old style of the front men that used to go out in front of these incredible sections and play. Winoni Harris, Jimmy Lunsford, Johnny Otis, Kay Kaiser, these band leaders, James Brown. It was clowning, and it was antics. And they saw that we were taking all the best of being front men with the antics and the humor that's implicit in this music, and then letting the musicians shine and letting them step out as all-stars. They saw that this is something that they could underwrite. And once they joined the band, then the Blues Brothers was really born. Then we had Matt Guitar Murphy, used to play with James Cotton's band. We had Cropper and Dunn, the Stax Volt backbones, and the greatest horn section players, session players in the world, Malone, Marini, and Rubin. And Paul Schaefer for that first record on the keyboards,
Yeah, the album, obviously, that was a natural to go and do that. But I never, when I watched you guys perform, whether it was on SNL, in the movie, in concert, afterwards, I never got the impression that you were acting, because it was just flowing through your blood. Like, it was never like, oh, they're just up there doing shtick, they're playing characters. I mean, it was really something that you lived.
Well, I suppose you could say that as actors, we do have to believe what we're doing.
Sure.
And John was a credible vocalist, and he could move really well. We know he could move well. And, the Elwood character, as I look back on it, wasn't really like not really like me in real life. It was a pretty buttoned-up performance in the movie. The Elwood, very little glint, very, not much of me shines through. It was quite buttoned up. I say that, I look back on it, and of course it looks like a different person to me 100 years and 100 pounds ago. But I go, that was a pretty good performance. And John, when he's about to go and write the check for the beer after Bob's Country Bunker, and the guy's saying, you owe me for the beer. And he says, well, I usually go over my brother's car. I sit down and I write out a check on the dashboard, And just the way he finesses that, and the way he delivered that, just so funny and perfect. Yeah. He was a comic master.
Yeah.
And we were trying to inject as much humor as we could into the idea of the front men who love and venerate this music. So that's what Cropper and Dunn saw. They saw the merits there. They saw that we were doing it in the right spirit.
And all that we're living through right now, we started putting up a screen in the backyard and doing backyard movies, almost like a drive-in, and having people over. And we had the Blues Brothers on a couple weeks ago, and I knew there was a new generation of fans. And there was my son's in his late teens, had people over and so forth. And they were just mesmerized by the fact that you had all these, and I forgot about it a little bit too, but James Brown, Cab Calloway, Aretha Franklin, Ray Charles, John Lee Hooker in this movie, and a movie that you wrote. And the first screenplay you ever wrote. And this movie is just so iconic still today.
Well, the music never grows old. That music is just, we hear Dock of the Bay and we listen to it. We don't turn the radio off. It's just a great song. There's so much music that just lives, and blues and R&B will always live and have a vibrancy. It was certainly an amazing summer to work with these artists, and I look back on it and I say, I don't think there was one no there when we approached them. They all saw that this was a meritorious thing to be doing. Mm-hmm. 40 years of cultural preservation, and we're still doing it now. Belushi and I go out, John's brother, Jimmy.
Yep.
We go out, and we credit those who wrote the songs. The songs we covered, we never took any publishing. We always left that with the writers. We could have bought out the publishing on many of the songs we covered, like many cover artists do, but we didn't choose to do that. We left that legacy with them and their estates and their descendants. So we got Mechanical Performance royalties on the records, but we never took publishing on the records. And whenever we played, Jimmy and I, we always talk about how this, you know, the songs live on, and that we just did a Willie Dixon song or a Little Milton song. We make sure we mention the artists, because that is the mission from God.
Really. It is. Absolutely is.
It really holds up.
It does.
You know? Yeah. And the tracks are so incredible. And just, the choreography, Carlton Johnson, he was the Temptations choreographer, and some of the best tracks in the movie are what we play in the Bluesmobile. Like, is that monaural track of Soothe Me? Mm-hmm. It's just crisp. Mm-hmm. It snaps, man. Yeah, it's hot.
Speaking of the Bluesmobile, you went through like 13 of those, I think. I think there was a load of those on set.
Yeah. It was terrific in terms of, you know, just being able to watch these artists work. Like, I didn't know how I was going to get off the stool and dance when Aretha started in that number.
Yeah,
I really didn't. I did. You know, it was my guts turned to jelly, and I was paralyzed from the waist down when she started to sing, you know, to the lip sync, to the track, as we do in musicals. You know, started to sing and started to move, and those her ladies got up off the stools and started. I thought I'm not going to be able to move. Sure, willpower how to get in and join the choreography there. I was astounded.
But that's because you had the respect. You had the respect for these people.
Oh, yeah, and just the movement of the music. Yeah. And just her, and there she was, looking so cute and just, you know, investing her talent in our vision, which is just wonderful.
Before I let you go, Dan, I want to talk about Crystal Head Vodka. It's such a, first of all, such a cool bottle. I mean, it's just beautiful. And what kind of put you out there to do that? I mean, was it just about like there's nothing that's really additive free out there, so you know, let's make something really fabulous that tastes good and that's actually a little bit better for you?
Yeah, I just didn't like what was put in more, you know, lesser priced vodkas. I didn't like that a cousin to antifreeze glycerol was put in there, and that a caustic cleanser lemonine or cousin to caustic cleanser oil lemonine was put in there. So we stripped all that out, and they added sugar, and we have an award-winning fluid. We have our Pride bottle out now. I call it our Celebration of Diversity bottle. It's a rainbow bottle. It sold out very quickly. We have a very large constituency devoted to our product because, first of all, quality, people who drink vodka like the quality, and we're a Canadian-made vodka. We are not a Russian-made vodka, and Canada's legalized same-gender preference marriage years, decades ago almost now, and we have a beautiful, loving, tolerant society where people can love people how and who and when they want. I respect Chicago as a place where there was really a foremost movement in the culture with the Boys Town being a safe enclave and now emerging as someplace that's, you know, where people can go and feel and be the way they want to be. So we celebrate that with our rainbow bottle, if you can get one. I don't know. They sold out pretty quick. But what you get in there is an award-winning fluid. We've won medals all over the world. And I like it. Our notes are sweet, vanilla, dry, crisp with a kick of heat off the finish. I like to take 2.5 ounces in a tumbler and slowly squeeze some tangerine juice in there.
Ooh, nice.
That's the crystal driver, yeah.
Love it. Love it. Love your passion for everything, Dan. And I got to tell you, I'm so grateful that you spent some time with us tonight and hanging out and talking about, you know, the legacy of this movie. But, you know, really what you created over your career is just something to celebrate. And I'm always, you know, proud to play this Blues Brothers movie because, you know, here in Chicago, we're proud to call it our very own.
Well, you know, the town embraced me and I'll always feel like it's my first home in the U.S. And a home away from home, indeed. And I can't wait to get back.
Thank you, Dan. All right. Be well, sir.
Take care. All right. Bye-bye.
Legendary Dan Aykroyd. All right. Top stories from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Coming up next on 720 WGN.